Mastoma Vidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare
So page 13, Sutra 7. Although it is established beyond a doubt that the Lord and His potency are simultaneously distinct and non-distinct, there are some people who argue that the Lord and His potency are only distinct. In the next sutra, the author refutes the idea that the transcendental potency is different from the Lord Himself. Tat chaktitas tatvarikyam iti chen na tadabhedhat. The Lord's transcendental potency is a separate, isolated principle, but it is only identical with Him. Summary of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. There is no distinction between the Lord and His Lordship. Both of these aspects are united in the Supreme Reality, who is one without a second. The power of burning is inseparable from fire, the diamond from its hardness. The body and the limbs are constituents of the same object. And the sun and the sunlight cannot be treated as two separate objects. Similarly, the Lord and His potency are not separate from each other. The Supreme Lord, Radha Krishna, is the undivided Supreme Reality. In his purport to Mantra 4, Srila Prabhupada explains that this non-difference should not be misunderstood. Quote, thus the different energies of the Lord are present everywhere. Although the Lord and His energies are non-different, one should not mistake these energies for the Supreme Truth. Nor should one wrongly consider that the Supreme Lord is distributed everywhere impersonally, or that He loses His personal existence. Men are accustomed to reaching conclusions according to their capacity for understanding. But the Supreme Lord is not subject to our limited capacity for understanding. For it is this reason that the Upanishads warn us that one cannot approach the Lord by his own limited potency. So, the thing is, if you say someone's a Lord, it means that they have to be a Lord of something. So what they're Lord of is also non-different. That's the thing. You can't separate the two. So, the being, having energy is the natural quality of the Lord. So it's his inherent nature. So that means you won't be able to separate them. At the same time, Prabhupada's pointing out that they are a separate principle, and in understanding that, one shouldn't think that all these different other false conclusions, that the Lord, by expanding, then he himself becomes diffused. You know, it's just like they'll say Brahman is made up of all the living entities, and so therefore there is no Brahman. When all the entities go back, then Brahman will be there, and things like this. Then you have a problem that if that's the case, then how would you ever become liberated? You work so hard, but there's other living entities that aren't doing that, and so how will all the Brahman become one? So then it's kind of a waste of time also. Because you're the good boy, you've come to the transcendental platform, but everybody else is still in illusion, so... You know, so, and at the same time as the materialist who thinks that the energy is non-different, being non-different, then worshipping matter is worshipping the Lord. Right? So that's why one has to be able to see it, that it's simultaneously different and non-different. Right? Then it works very easily. But you also see is that there's the difficulty that some will see it as different, but then they cannot see, means the non-difference. So then they will consider the Lord and His creation are different. So therefore, He's beyond the creation. He's the source of the creation. He's the Lord of the creation, but actually it's being separated. He has no control over it. Right?
Yes. Would the Madras fall in that category of always seeing the Lord and His potency as distinct?
No, no. Here we're talking about... They're not saying... Yeah, I mean... But this is not concerning your differences in transcendental view. The difficulty here is seeing the difference on His connection with His energy. That on the material platform, then you'll come up with these ideas. You'll come up with your deism, or you'll think it's all one, and so therefore the Lord is distributed, or we can worship the nature and it's the same thing. So you're pantheistic and all these other elements. So when it's simultaneously one and different, then all these elements are removed. So it becomes easier to explain it. Like, we can deal with things sometimes very easily that the other transcendental schools take more to explain, right? Because of this principle. Same time as that's also what makes the fine points that it's harder to understand, because it's not just this or just that. Does that make sense? So being able to understand that they're the same and different. Now, the reason for understanding this, he says, there's different, for the materialist, there's different capacities. Right? Depending upon his conditioning, therefore he has a particular capacity. Like, spiritual doesn't have a problem with capacity, because it's on the same platform, so there's not a disturbance there. But for the... materialist, he has a capacity of what he can grasp. And so, depending on ignorance, passion, or goodness, then they have a difference in how they'll approach or deal with all these things. Here someone may protest. It is not so that by creating the material worlds and performing other activities, the Supreme Personality of Godhead becomes affected by that activity, and his nature becomes different from what it was before. Does he not become enamored of what he has created? In the next sutra, the author refutes this misconception. Kartap yavikarat svatantriyat. Because he is the absolute autocrat, he does not become transformed, even though he is the creator. Summary of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary. All universal laws are creations of the Lord. These laws are insurmountable by the power of the inconceivable divine potency. It is a law of the Lord that whoever creates will definitely be biased due to his willingness for creation. But the Supreme Lord is not bound by this law, and thus he remains unbiased or unchanged even after his creation of the sentient objects, non-sentient objects, and their mutual relations. Means when you create something, then you're changed. Right? You've made something, and so it's included in you. It becomes part of your... But here, is because there was no difference in the first place, its manifestation or not, of his own nature doesn't change him. So this is a law of nature. But remember, it's a law of the energy. His energy will act that way. Right? Because it's dependent. Like that. So then the idea that I've created something, therefore that will change, it means I'm dependent upon what's been created. Does that make sense? So that's the thing. But he, being independent, he's not dependent upon what has been created. Does this make sense?
Maharaj, This is the case when the gopis ask the moon, the topic that Krishna is the eternal brahmachari. And he explains that Krishna is the same way that he only eats grass. And he takes all the ladus, samosas, and he says, the same way I am only eating grass, because everything is a transformation. when Krishna is leading, it's like a hand in a shadow. He doesn't get involved.
Hand in a shadow, or probably gives the example of the child playing with the reflection in the mirror. It's non-different, you know, like that. At the same time, you can see that it's a difference, but it's a non-difference. Yes?
So does that mean that the Lord is transcendental even to Vastutraya?
No, but he is Vastutraya. See, the point is we're not. We are Satchitananda, but we're not the source of Satchitananda. We just are Satchitananda. Just like electricity is not the source of electricity, it just is electricity. Right? But the generator is the source of electricity. So the generator is not affected by electricity. It produces, it doesn't change its nature. It's just whether the electricity is manifest or not. So the Lord creating is just, he's expanding himself, but because of the element of difference, then it's different than us, because we're not actually creating it. But for the Lord, it's non-different from him, so it's not a problem. Is that okay? And another aspect of the Lord's supreme independence is shown in the purport to Sri Ishopanishad Mantra 12. The Sanskrit word asambhuti refers to those who have no independent existence. Sambhuti is the absolute personality of Godhead, who is absolutely independent of everything. In the Bhagavad Gita 10.2, the absolute personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, states, "Neither the hosts of demigods nor the great sages know my origin or opulence. For in every respect I am the source of the demigods and the sages." Thus Krishna is the origin of the powers delegated to demigods, great sages, and mystics. Although they are endowed with great powers, these powers are limited. And thus it is very difficult for them to know how Krishna himself appears by his own internal potency, in the form of a man. Many philosophers and great rishis or mystics try to distinguish the absolute from the relative by their tiny brain power. This can only help them reach the negative conception of the absolute without realizing any positive trace of the absolute. Definition of the absolute by negation is not complete, right? Because they'll look at it and go, okay, well, the Lord can't be this. This has some element. It's temporary, but the Lord's not, so it can't be this. So, you know, like this, they'll go through, but they can't actually tell what is positive. They'll only actually be able to understand negative, because they're only dealing with the energy. So he's not the energy, but that doesn't define what he is. He's beyond the energy. So therefore, all the qualities, since he's not energy, all the qualities of energy he can't have, so therefore, then you end up with nothingness. That's the problem with it. Such negative definitions lead one to create a conception of one's own. Thus one imagines that the absolute must be formless and without qualities. Such negative qualities are simply reversals of relative material qualities and are therefore also relative. By conceiving of the absolute in this way, one can at the utmost reach the impersonal effulgence of God, known as Brahman, but one cannot make further progress to Bhagavan, the personality of Godhead. So, a negation of one thing, the result is not actually something else. So, the material, and then you negate the material, you're still ending up with something relative. Right? So it's actually a material conception that the Lord is impersonal. Right? And that's the ultimate. That's material. That he has an impersonal feature and there's non-difference between him and the impersonal. That's not impersonal philosophy. Right? We deal with Brahman, transcendence. That's not impersonal. Impersonal is that's the ultimate. So that's why we see is we can't tell the difference. So Brahman is non-material, but at the same time, is then there's the person beyond that. That they can't tell by their intelligence. because you only have material nature, and it's not that. So therefore, it's full of qualities, so it must be have no qualities. But what they even miss there is that the Brahman is the effulgence of his qualities, just the qualities aren't manifest. When they say that the Brahman is qualityless, that's not correct. It's formless, but not qualityless. Therefore, there's nirgun and sagun Brahman understanding. So we're dealing with sagun, right? Brahman has qualities. They're unmanifest, right? But they have qualities, right? Because if it's non-different from the Lord, he's unlimited qualities. So that means that Brahman must also have qualities, right? This is the point. But, so that's why what theirs is a material conception, because this has qualities that can't have qualities. So it's not even an actual understanding of Brahman. Right? The formless, all-pervading, these kind of things. But if you say something's formless, that's the quality of it. It's all-pervading, that's the quality of it. You know what I'm saying? So they've reached the limit of their intelligence to the point where they're bewildered by their own thoughts and they can't even understand this. So that's the other point, is that the Lord is never overwhelmed by his own potency. Yes?
Raj, how can they understand that, or how can a lay person understand that something has qualities, but they are not manifested?
Let's say you have a business. So, is there the potential of economic development? But, what if you can't see it? Yeah, but that's the point. So there is such a thing as you can have the potential, but it's not manifest. The dog is sitting there peacefully. But he could be barking. Right? Does that make sense?
So, Brahman can manifest those.
The creation is coming from Brahman, but the point is it's still dead matter. It's not superior energy, or it's not Brahman, it's not the Lord himself. It's his external potency, right? So it's not the jivas, it's not the internal, and it's not the Lord. But that it has what we would perceive as life and everything happening, that's because of the pervasion of the Brahman throughout it. Does that make sense?
It still remains not unchanged.
Yes, it remains unchanged. I mean, because like the pillar, it's strength that holds it up. The manifestation of strength is in material energy. It's in matter. You understand? It's not in the spiritual, but in the spiritual world, it's manifest within the spiritual. Does that make sense? Okay? In the next sutra, the author reveals that the Supreme Lord does not increase when he creates the universe. Neither does he become less when he destroys the universe. Sadaika rupa purnatvat. Because he is perfect and complete, his nature is always unchanged. Summary of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura's commentary. In the Ishu Upanishad it is said, the Supreme Personality is perfect and complete. And because he is completely perfect, all emanations from him, such as this phenomenal world, are perfectly equipped as complete wholes. Whatever is produced of the complete whole is also complete in itself. Because he is a complete whole, even though many complete units emanate from him, he remains the complete balance. Here someone may ask, if the Supreme Personality of Godhead is perfect and complete, then what motivates him to create the material world? In the next sutra, the author answers the question. Sutra 10. Karunyam tat kriya hetur nanyat apta kamatvat. Compassion is the motive of his actions. He has no other motive. For his every desire is at once fulfilled without any effort on his part. Right? It means Krishna doesn't have to do something to please himself. Right? He's automatically happy, you know, without any effort, because his energies take care of it. So there's no need to do anything. In the Shruti Shastra, it is said, the conditioned soul act to fulfill their material desires. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has no need to act to fulfill his desires, for his every wish is at once filled without his having to act. In the Smriti Shastra, it is said, there is nothing that the Supreme Personality of Godhead does not attain merely by wishing for it. Right? This is the term satya-sankalpa, means whatever he desires then happens. Shruti means the Veda, and Smriti means what's not the Veda. It means, would mean any other work. No, Upanishads are part of the Veda. They're just the fourth section of the Veda. The Veda itself has four sections. It has the Samhita, which is the verses that we would call the Veda. Then it has the Brahmanas that explain how to use the Veda for ritual. Right? The Arankas explain the esoterics of the ritual, right, and of those verses. And the Upanishad section explains the philosophy of the verses. Okay? So then your Puranas, you know, Mahabharata, all these would all be called Smriti. So Shruti is the Veda, Smriti is the tradition of the great personalities. How, understanding the Shruti, they apply it in their life and they discuss it with others. So that being, those conversations being documented, that's Smriti. Right? Like, Brahma knows Shruti, then the sages who know Shruti, then they have a discussion on Dharma Shastra. So that discussion is then, how do you say, compiled as Manas Samhita. Right? It's documented. So that's Smriti. So Smriti means tradition. Right? You have the Veda and then you have tradition.
This means that all the books written by the Goswami.
That's all Smriti. Yeah. Any book that's written is Smriti. You understand? What is not written, that's Shruti. So Shruti, it's always exists.
Sometimes, Maharaj, I've seen people using the term Shruti to mean paravidya and Smriti to mean aparavidya. Is that a wrong?
No, because Veda is also aparavidya. The Upanishads, that's paravidya. Like that. You know, no, it doesn't.
It's not a proper use.
No.
Because Goswami is, of course,
paravidya. Yeah, that's transcendental. Pancharatra is paravidya. You know. Gita is paravidya, but it's Smriti. So there's some groups of persons who only accept the Vedic literature. I mean, not the Vedic, means the Veda. They won't deal with any other literature. Because within the Veda, all these different topics are there, so they can somehow or another understand what to do. Because from the Brahmanas, you get your Dharma Sutras, so then they know what they should do from that. Manu gives a bigger explanation. So. The conditioned souls are forced to work hard to fulfill their material desires. And even after such hard work, they are still dependent on the Lord's mercy for attaining their goals. Because they work, but the result coming is still depending on the Supersoul awarding it. In Sri Upanishad Mantra 8, The Supreme Lord is called the sufficient, self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desire since time immemorial. The Lord is independent in fulfilling his desires, such as Sankalpa, but the living entities are dependent on him. In the purport to Sri Ishopanishad Mantra 8, Srila Prabhupada writes, God is described here as Paribhu, the greatest of all. No one is greater than or equal to him. Other living entities are described here as beggars who ask goods from the Lord. The Lord supplies the things the living entities desire. The entities were equal to the Lord in potency. They were omnipotent and omniscient. There would be no question of their begging from the Lord, even for so-called liberation. Real liberation means going back to Godhead. Liberation as conceived of by an impersonalist is a myth. And begging for sense gratification has to continue eternally unless the beggar comes to his spiritual senses and realizes his constitutional position. So here, Eva made a point that the liberation as conceived of by the impersonalist is a myth. It doesn't actually exist.
Which refers to Mayavadi liberation.
No, not necessarily. Because they're thinking that you will eternally be liberated. So even they come to the Brahman platform, the impersonal still, it's temporary. At some point, he'll fall down. So it doesn't exist. What the Mayavadis are talking about really is a myth. Right? But for the impersonalists, they're dealing with an aspect of the Lord. Right? But they're only accepting one of three parts. So that being the ultimate, that's a myth. That being an eternal place that the soul can situate himself, that's a myth. Right? But they have to have some inspiration, since they don't actually have devotional. And they've seen the weakness in material. Then that only leaves them the spiritual. But they don't actually have a full or a complete spiritual understanding. Because only if you accept the Lord who is complete, then you have a complete understanding. So they're not accepting the Lord as that, how you say, they're not dealing with the Lord as complete. It means they don't see any fault in Brahman, but they don't understand that there's a complete, that there's more. So therefore their understanding can't be more, right? So. By the mercy of the Lord, the liberated devotee is also satya-sankalpa. This is explained in the purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 5.4.5, where Srila Prabhupada describes the symptoms of a jivan mukta. Another symptom is apipata, which means that he has no desire other than to engage in the devotional service of Krishna, his dearmost pursuable Lord. A further symptom is satyakama, which indicates that all his desires are directed to the Supreme Truth, Krishna. He does not want anything else. He is satya sankalpa. Whatever he desires is fulfilled by the grace of Krishna. First of all, he does not desire anything for his material benefit. And secondly, if he desires anything at all, he simply desires to serve the Supreme Lord. That desire is fulfilled by the Lord's grace. That is called satya sankalpa. So here it's not that it's fulfilled by his own energy like the Lord, but the Lord fulfills it. So that means the devotee, whatever he desires, that's fulfilled. Because he has no desire other than pleasing the Lord. So naturally his interaction is with the Lord, so there's whatever one desires is always fulfilled.
When he desires sons or sisters, he gets them, and with them he serves the Lord.
We were reading, or you were reading? He desires sons and sisters. You remember anything, sons and sisters? I don't think so.
Maybe it's some of them.
Oh, I see. Sons and daughters? That's certainly how. No, I mean, I don't think we read that here. It must be something else. Maybe you connect it to the point and then...
When you say that what it is, the devotee desire is fulfilled by the Lord, this means what types of innovation of devotee has his desire fulfilled? Any devotee?
Means what's connected to the Lord, yes. So what's not connected to the Lord, that is not. Then it's according to, you know, other elements.
Suppose the devotee has, he's doing something for Krishna, but his consciousness is not really...
Yes, so it means that element that is, that's what's fulfilled, and that what's not is not. You know, unless Krishna sees that there would be some benefit, you know, to fulfilling or not, then, in a sense. So here we're saying is by the mercy, the liberated devotee is what is being defined here. So someone, he has no material desire because he's liberated. So whatever he desires, because it's only in connection with the Lord kindly fulfills. Right? But if there's a devotee acting in the conditioned state, then that fulfilling or not is up to the Lord, whatever will be best for his personal development. Right? If by fulfilling the desire they'll come closer, he may be filled. By fulfilling it, they'll go farther away, he may not fulfill it. Right? Like, because he knows what's going on. We don't. We may have an idea. Right? Right? Because sankalpa means you have a determination. So satya means it's truth. So he has a determination, he wants to serve Krishna in a particular way. It comes true. Right? That's the meaning of satya sankalpa. In Srimad Bhagavatam 3.7.2.3, Vidura asks the following question. O great Brahmana, since the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the complete spiritual whole and is unchangeable, how is he connected with the material bodies of nature and their activities? If this is his pastime, how do the activities of the unchangeable take place and exhibit qualities without the modes of nature? Boys are enthusiastic to play with other boys or with various diversions because they are encouraged by desire. But there is no possibility of such desire for the Lord because he is self-satisfied and detached from everything at all times. Sri Maitreya Muni answered in these words, Srimad Bhagavatam 3.7.9. Certain conditioned souls put forward the theory that the Supreme Brahman or the Supreme Personality Godhead is overcome by illusion or maya, and at the same time they maintain that he is unconditioned. This is against all logic. What is the underlined selfish interest of the Lord in performing his pastimes? The reply is that the Lord is not motivated by any type of selfish interest because he is free of selfish desires whatsoever. Only his mercy for the conditioned souls is the reason for his pastimes. Right? So it's just his mercy that makes it function. We do something because we have a desire. He doesn't have a desire, so it's just out of his kindness that he's interacting. Yes.
Earlier we were talking about the sportive nature. That's desireless, sportive. That's just kind of a fact.
Just a fact. He's sportive. I mean, he's energetic. So means it's just like, would we say, means like, let's say we had a youth, and we say he's sportive.
Yeah.
If we, you know, do we hear, you know, an old man, he is sportive?
Very rare.
Yes, very rare. Because it's lack of energy.
Yeah.
Right? So the point is that since he is the complete, how you say, energetic, he is complete in all energy, therefore he's naturally sportive. Yes.
And so in this connection, Maharaj, you were saying that because the Lord is fully satisfied as Atma, then whatever is does with his creation, it just makes him happy to make us happy. He increases his pleasure by making us happy.
Increases, yes.
but therefore it's all based on his mercy, whatever else.
Yeah, it's still just his mercy. He's still just interacting with the living entities. Just impressed with the how much energy they put into crying.
Yeah, that's really
because the natural crying has a different thing. This one is like comes off with a certain takes a breath and it comes out with a certain force and then it keeps and it just keeps it going. It should be either getting more or getting less or something, you know, it's like waves.
It's really impressive how long it goes before they actually inhale like and then go for a second. It's silent for almost 30 seconds and then
It's really scary. You don't know where they're going to take it. So this one's emotional rather than actual, they hurt or something like that. Because it's still exactly the same.
Like a siren.
Huh? Oh, there's two now. Okay, now there's another competition. Who is more? Who needs more attention than the other one? I've even sometimes seen them, they're looking and looking around and nobody's noticing. Yeah. If nobody's noticing, then it kind of goes down. If somebody is, then they go that direction and make more. You know.
Same when they fall. They only start crying when their parents start.
Yeah, it means if they're actually hurt, that's another thing. Yeah. Sometimes it, Chaitanya was saying that is, what was that? Yeah, I wonder which one it is. But he'd be running along and fall on his face. And then his mother would say, oh, he's offering obeisances. And then he didn't think of it like that. So he'd just get up and not cry.
That was pretty smart.
Yeah, yeah, very smart. He had I think it was a cousin. Cousin, you know, she's small, running along, falls off on her face. And then she goes, oh, look, she killed an ant. And then she gets up and starts looking for the ant, you know. She completely forgets it just fell on her face, you know. So. I've only heard of these things in India.
Somehow. Prabhupada also did like this.
Huh?
Prabhupada also did like this.
He's from India, right? So the point is that for it, see, somehow or another there's the idea in the West that either, you know, how you say it, either stop it, or they say console it, or like there's not we're not commune. It's a very nice word for it, but it just means that you
cater to the need.
Yeah, it means not cater to the need, but commiserate.
Commiserate.
Yeah, you commiserate with it. It means they're feeling that way, so you understand and appreciate and take the same mood. So sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. But in India, they generally just use the thing of distract. Means that doing one thing, you just move that attention to another, so there's no impediment. You know, like I saw the exact same thing happen with two parents. I'm not sure it was. I mean, someone wasn't paying attention. So now, so then they're in the Bhagavatam class was in the temple room. And so at the back of the temple room is the book case. And then the bookcase being there, then there's all the glass and there's things inside, right? So in both cases, the mother was holding the baby, you know, facing her so the baby could see the glass. And so in both cases, then the baby started, you know, banging on the glass, trying to get at, you know, whatever's inside. So then, the one mother is, you know, saying, no, don't do that, this turns the kid around and so many things like this. The kid starts crying, so the mom has to get up and go outside. And after, you know, some time comes back in. They saw then the Indian parent bangs on that and she just looks at the kid and goes, ooh, like this and points at something else. God only knows what, the chandelier or anything. The kid just kind of turns around and says, you know, like that. So it's like, you know, done. So it's like, so. The distraction is very important.
You can do it with grown-ups too.
Hmm?
You can do it with grown-ups too.
Yeah. No, it's. Yeah. It could be. Could be the teachers. Because
maybe now the teachers
are. They're all lamenting. Yeah. Okay, only his mercy. So this is also important because mercy. Yeah, that mercy. Okay, and so this is the end of chapter 1 of the Sri Tattva Sutra. Okay, chapter 17. A summary of chapter 1. Chapter 1 of Sri Tattva Sutra pertains to the first topic of the Upanishads, the nature of Brahman. Sri Krishna is one without a second. He is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Although transcendental material qualities, he possesses expansive, immense potencies, inconceivable to mundane perception. Innumerable contradictory qualities simultaneously exist in him. Is nothing uncommon or wonderful. This is just his natural state of existence. For us, it's special and wonderful, but this is what gives us our attraction, right, to the Lord, because he's different, right? Lord Sri Krishna's form is eternal, fully conscious and blissful. It's not perceivable by mundane faculties. It can be realized only by transcendental, unalloyed devotional service. He is beyond the influence of time and space, although transcendental to matter and spirit. He expands through his device diverse energies as the cosmic manifestation, consisting of both matter and spirit. For his pastimes, he is identical with his transcendental potency. The supremely independent Lord is never affected by his creation, although he is the cause of all causes. Since he is the complete absolute truth, the cause of manifestation or annihilation does not change his fullness. Devoid of any material need and desire, he performs his transcendental activities only due to his causeless mercy. Right? So this is the Upanishadic form. So it is establishing tattva, right? So this is Tattva Sutra. Right, his position. What is so? This is this first section is what is Godhead, right? What is the Supreme Lord? What is Brahman, right? So now in here we see is those three aspects that are in the Dasamul, right? So he's one without a second. He's the Supreme. That's been established. He's the source of all energies. That's been established, like that. Sir, is the kid upstairs going to survive?
He's falling asleep.
He's falling asleep. Got bored, right? Okay. What was the problem?
He just fell down and got some cotton on his knee.
Oh, okay. You put some medicine in there.
He's crying.
Okay.
There's no bruise or nothing.
Oh, he just fell over and felt he deserved some. He had some well-deserved attention coming.
We give him some chocolates.
Now he's falling asleep. Okay. Okay. Appropriate medicine.
It's quite a sight. He's whining while sleeping.
He's sleeping. We should play this recording for him in 5 years.
Yeah. Sorry? Oh, it's your son. Oh, okay.
He's being well looked up.
Okay, so now you know when he falls over, the chocolate is the proper medicine, right?
I know he didn't sleep very well last night.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think that was hard for me than it was for him.
Yeah, of course.
But you might start doing that every day to get chocolate.
No, not necessarily, because there's something else. There's something else.
It's amazing what boys are like. They kind of like, they're like little men. Like when Rami used to get hurt, he was like 1 year old.
So does that mean in the converse that men are like little boys?
No, I mean that kind of, like stoic.
Okay, no, they can be.
The child is the father of the man.
The child is the father of the man, yeah. This thing is that here, because we're dealing with tattva, so you don't get into all the fine details. But when you're dealing with rasa, then you get into all the details of the moods and interactions, and then you see is why these things happen and come up and all that. So this also shows the the element of why the Vedic system, at least for the boys, then has the option. It has the element that a child can only be raised under the protection of the parental rasa. But the difficulty is you have the attached parental rasa and the non-attached. So parental rasa means that you're giving appropriate guidance for the situation. It means what are your values? You're giving those values to the child, and therefore that's why they grow up properly. That's what's happening in the parental rasa. Then for our own purpose, then there's that absorption in all the emotions that we feel that's what we're going to gain from this. But we see that though it will be a reason or a drive for taking part in the process, it's not necessarily always beneficial. Right? Because the parent has some emotional needs or desires they want from the relationship, but it's not necessarily the best for the growing of the child. So that's why then the teacher is the third element in the equation. So you have mother, you have father, and you have teacher. Because for the teacher, they don't have the physical or biological attachment. So then in looking at it, then it's what will develop what will make them develop properly. So because there's no emotional investment, that means one is not affected by it. Does that make sense? So it's not that it's impersonal or not considering the individual, it's just considering what aspect is going to bring out the best development. Right? So the grihastha, because of the emotional investment, then the exchange will develop, but it's not necessarily that it will mature. You know what I'm saying? That's the thing, is that, so in other words, that the kid has a problem, they get attention. That's parental rasa. But the kind of attention that they get according to what either you think they should get or what they think they should get, that's not necessarily what's going to be progressive. Does that make sense? So that's why part of the experience of growing up then includes the teacher, which means then it will be looked at in what is actually the position, right? So if the child falls over and gets hurt and the parent doesn't pay any emotional attention, the child will feel something's lacking, right? But they're not actually hurt, but they want attention. And they know if they cry, they'll get that. You know, it's just something you learn. Because when you're small, if you're doing nothing, then no one pays that much attention. Or a little bit, you know, pleasant. But if you cry, you immediately get the whole house is there, right? Because you can cry loud enough that no one else can do anything. They can't think, they can't sleep, they can't, you know, like this. So one learns that by crying you can get anything done. I wonder if this is something to do with some cult thing. It's like that. Does this make some sense here? Like that. So then, but if the teacher, because you're not actually hurt and you're not going to get any emotional attention out of this, but the actual position is dealt with, you can't really complain. So therefore, both are cultivated. I'm saying you need that foundation of that emotional support from the parent, because that's the environment you're going to function in when you grow up. But the process from having gained that and growing up, that's another thing altogether. Does that make sense? You know, it says the parental relationship for the family is the interaction. Right? Does that make sense? You know, when they're babies, sometimes they're too small, you know, and then when they're bigger, they're too big. So there's kind of that spot in between when they're, you can communicate, but they're still dependent, but they're nice. You know, that's kind of like, you know, that's the, But you know, before that, you know, it's mixed, and after that, it's mixed. You know, so kind of like, you know, I'd say, like 3 to 10. That's kind of like perfection. You know, does that make sense? But for the teacher, then that's the point, is they can take it beyond where the parental ras loses its idyllic emotional. Yeah, well, not pursuit or just manifestation, you know, from 11 basically until you would count them as, you know, mature, if that ever happens. But, you know, like that, yes.
Because of the decreasing dependence on the child.
Yeah, because there's no dependency, and that's the difficulty, is that if they're not dependent, because it's like the child is fully dependent, so you have to be involved. But because they're your child, by attachment, you're motivated to be involved. So therefore, then the faulty concept comes up as the teacher can't actually want to do something for the kid because they're not attached. But the point is, the teacher is doing, because that's their job, right? So when we say, well, the job, that's impersonal. No, that's a mode of goodness. The parent being attached, that's a mode of passion and ignorance. Passion because they desire something, ignorance because they think the body has something to do with yours. Does that make sense? So therefore, the motive, one's in goodness, one's in passion or ignorance. But for someone in knowledge, then they also add this element of goodness to it because they understand what the Shastra says and what's the proper way to raise a child, how to make them Krishna conscious, how to make them into a human. So you're adding that too, so it purifies. So that's why the Grihastha ashram becomes, therefore, an ashram. It's progressive. Right? Does that make sense? So someone who follows Shastra, we will call that ashram. You know, Grihastha ashram. Right? But if they're not following Shastra, then we don't call it ashram. Right? We don't call it Grihamedi ashram. Like that, you know. You know, hedonistic, gross sense gratifier, ashram. You know, we don't use these terms. Like that. Does that make sense?
So it's the Naishkarmya that makes the...
Yeah, then the more the teacher can work on that Naishkarmya means they're doing the proper thing, but at the same time is it's not driven by attachment, because if the attachment's not there, then there may not be that drive. You know, so as long as everything's going nice, the parent's very attached, is driven to take care nicely, but if something goes wrong, then, you know, then it goes the other way. But Dronacharya, he's teaching the student who has been predestined to kill him. But he doesn't have a problem because there's no material attachment. Does that make sense? But the parent, when he finds out his child is working against him, that he, you know, cuts him off, writes him out of his will, does this and that. So, you understand the two extremes, so that the teacher can function in the middle. That's why it's a brahminical occupation. Does that make sense? Anybody can teach, you know, certain things, but to actually teach ashram, that's a brahminical occupation. You know what I'm saying? You know some English, you can teach English. You know some music, you can teach. So arts, anyone can teach. But you actually change the lifestyle, that's the Brahman, right? Because the Kshatriya won't do it because, you know, it's a challenge, you know, so you're not doing it, so, you know, you're useless, you know. And the Vaishya, unless he's getting some profit from it, why he should do it. And the Shudra, unless there's emotional exchange, then they're not going to be inspired. So that means at least that only the Brahman can do it. So that's why it's hard to find teachers. Yes.
On this topic, if we have, let's say, a teacher detached properly, is it possible that in the process of educating, there may be a need from the side of a children to get some, let's say, emotional investment or compromise on this?
No, but the point is that emotional investment is how the exchange is performed. But the point is what we're saying here is just because you think you need it doesn't mean you require it. That's the point. So for the parent, they know maybe he doesn't require it, but because how they're dealing, it's very hard to avoid it. Well, the teacher can. You know what I'm saying? It's not that the parent doesn't know what's better. It's just that sometimes it's hard to do because of the bodily attachment. Does that make sense? Well, the teacher not having that bodily attachment, then it makes it easier. Right? And the child knowing that, they know what they can do and what they can't do. Well, the parent, they know they can try, and if it doesn't work, then they can always try it with the other parent. You know, so they can they have this whole mafia going on. Yes.
When something happens to your child, it feels like it's happening to you actually.
Yes.
Physically.
Yeah, yeah. Emotionally. Well, that's why we're sitting here laughing about it, and she's not.
That's very difficult. I mean, you can put that aside, and you have to, obviously. But
yeah.
It's a lot, because as I teach, it's a lot easier when you're teaching. So that you're not attached.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
You care for them, but you're not.
Yeah.
You know, you don't feel everything they feel.
Yeah. Like, yes.
I remember people would say, oh, you have to realize your daughter has separate karma to you. You know, that was a really, that they can't come into this world with your own, with their own karma, and they
yeah.
have their own experiences and things that they have to learn, and that's a really hard thing.
Yeah.
You think that you can actually control what they experience, but
yeah.
they
no. Yeah, well, that's why going through the whole ashram, that vanaprast means you figured out you're not in control. So you just basically is that you just let go. That's what vanaprast is for. That's why it's not that one is not in the grihastha situation. What's happened is one is let go. We try to take it, no, vanaprastha means not in the grihastha situation. The situation is the grihastha ashram, but the mentality has changed. One knows one's not in control. So therefore, direct devotional service becomes the prominent focus rather than all the little other things. Because one knows that one can't be satisfied on this spiritual platform by material emotion. And you can't control how the material energy is going to unfold. So it's just, these are all part of the process. That's why if it's done in knowledge, then when the natural, doubting of material life comes into existence, one naturally just switches from the material to the spiritual, right? Because one's been cultivating them both. So then one can see is that the spiritual is stable and of a higher nature and the other is not, right? So then that becomes the impetus for vanaprastha life, right? But the modern, those from, let's say, you know, more older traditional backgrounds appreciate this, and then it's, grows old gracefully and stuff like that. But the modern, they kind of seem to have given a term to this. They call it midlife crisis. And so it's like it didn't work, you know. I didn't become satisfied by this whole lifetime invested in the family and business, so I have to find something else that's going to do it. And so they just take on a new grihastha perspective from something completely different. You know, like the Mayavadi, if this is not working, then the opposite must be. You know, I've been, you know, in the office doing everything, and I said, I'll go crazy, you know, go skydiving, climb mountains, do something, you know, something like this. You know, does that make sense? Or?
So when people have those midlife crises, it's usually when they should be renouncing.
That's when they should be moving on to vanaprastha. That's what it's meant for. It's hardwired into the living entity to happen. Yeah, it means you just, yeah. But
good target for preaching.
Yeah, yeah. It means if you can use it. But the point is unfortunately, because for many, they haven't scientifically dealt with the vanaprastha ashram, grihastha ashram, they're not actually ready for vanaprastha. So at least hopefully when the doubts come up again later, when they're, you know, in their 60s and 70s, hopefully at that time they'll be able to retire. Does that make sense? So the point is to deal with attachment with knowledge, by doing that, then it makes it, right? It makes it progressive. Is that okay? Yes?
We see many times that the devotees after some years, after the end of 50, they again remarry.
That's because they didn't, they weren't able to experience what they're looking for in grihastha life when they were younger. So, but problem is now that they're getting married again, it doesn't mean they have any more knowledge. Generally, they're a little bit better at it. They're a little bit more surrendered. They're a little bit more willing to accommodate the other person and their needs and desires and not simply be working for themselves. So they'll generally do a better job. So they may get a better effect. But if it's more scientific and understood, then from the beginning, then one shouldn't have that problem. And two, even if they do have the problem, they'll go through it better and actually be able to drop it. Does that make sense? You're looking at the principle here. What is grihastha ashram? That you have so many material desires, but that's just conditioning. It's not the nature of the soul. But if one knows that these are the desires, so this is how God's laws, as we were saying, you can't get around God's laws. This is how God's laws say it'll work. Right? There's laws, how a man deals with a woman, a woman with a man, parents with children, you know, children with parents, all these different things, how you deal with money, how you deal with society. There's laws. You follow them, it works. You don't follow them, it'll never work. It doesn't matter what your philosophy is, it still doesn't matter. Does that make sense? So, the Shastra says, therefore live your life like this. And if you do that, then you'll be able to see the natural separation between what it is you're gaining from the material endeavor and the spiritual, you know, from all your endeavors. Because you're supposed to be trying to do both at once, or at least clearly this is material, this is spiritual. And then introduce the spiritual elements into the what one would consider material. Then it starts to, then you can see is what is actually giving the happiness. You know what I'm saying? Because the point is like this. The child is at a particular age, right? And you're getting a particular kind of interaction, right? The baby's totally dependent. You don't take care, it'll die. So you feel that 100% need, right? But when they get a little bit older, when they're two, they don't want any help. They want to do everything themselves. So it's gone. So if it was actually that living entity, you know, or it was that body, why is it gone? It was simply a potency of the Lord of that particular stage in childness that was manifesting. And now it's not. And it's gone. The rest of the life, it won't be there. Try all you like. Still, it won't come back. So neither are you controlling of it, and neither are they the source of it. So the relationship is, at these times, these flavors will be available. You deal with them properly, then you actually see what's going on. Right? And having dealt with them properly, then you don't need to deal with them again. Right? Because it's an illusion that this jiva needs a family. Not here. Spiritual world, yes, but here, no. Because it's temporary. Why do you want something that goes away? You know? That's the thing. So the point is the soul needs something that's relations that are eternal. They're not found here. But here's a reflection of there. So the concepts are basically the same. But the difference is there they're in a relationship to the Lord. Here they're not. So that's why they're frustrating. They seem to be giving you something, but it's gone. Krishna's eternal, so you've done something for Him or interacted with Him. That's eternal. Anytime you think about that, Krishna is there. You know what I'm saying? It's in the present. It's in pure goodness. But remembering that this happened with the child, you know, 10 years before, that's in the past. It's in ignorance. It's gone. And it's not actually that situation that, I mean, it's not the relationship and the individuals involved that generated it. It's the Lord that generated it. It's his potency that you experienced. So then that'll only create lamentation, you know, loss, insecurity, dependency. It's all those different things. So that's a problem. But if your security is in Krishna, your dependency is in Krishna, there's no problem. Does that make sense? So that's why if it's done with knowledge, then it's so much easier, so much better. In fact, technically, it should work nicer. Because if you follow the laws, you get a better result than if you don't follow the laws. You know what I'm saying? You know, you put your, how you say, you know, all the, you know, fruits and this and that in the blender, you know, and some sugar and that, and, you know, one of the lug nuts off your scooter, you know, and then turn it on, then you won't get the result you wanted. You know, because you're going against a law. You know, no lug nuts in the mixer when you're making a drink. Right? Even if you're not making a drink. Anytime you're blending anything in a blender, no lug nuts. Right? It's just a, you know, how you say? Immutable would be the immutable law. Yes. Unless the lug nuts made out of chocolate. But generally you never see chocolate lug nuts. So yeah, so no lug nuts. It's just the way it is. Okay? That makes sense? You want to know what a lug nut is. You understand? So the problem's not that someone's getting married at 50 or getting married again at 50 or getting married again and again at 50. You know what I'm saying? The problem, yeah, or yeah, how you say, if they're coming in the Elizabeth Taylor Sampradaya, then, but that's not actually the problem. We'll look at it, that's the problem. No, that's not the problem. The problem is that means they still have the material needs of grihastha life. But why hasn't it been already dealt with? So either they were ignoring that they had that need, and were, you know, saying no, you know, like this due to a false ego. Or they were sincere, but they didn't have enough information, so they didn't understand that they required. Or it means that they went through the Grihastha Ashram and they didn't really have a clue what they were doing. You know? Otherwise, where does the saying come, can't live with them, can't live without them? Where does that come from? Right? So it's only by knowledge that one can deal properly. So the point is, the problem is not that they're getting married again. The problem is, do they have the knowledge to go through it to make it successful so that they lose their attachment and they don't have to get married again? Because, see, the problem is even if, you know, you're very, even if you're a luminary in the, you know, Elizabeth Taylor Sampradaya, there is a kind of like a
time limit.
Yeah, the time limit, right? You know, it's called death. You know, you can't get married again once you're dead. Because if you could, I'm sure that there'd be plenty of people marrying dead old men to get their money, right? You know? Right? So at least you got to marry them long enough to have the will go through and all that. So that takes a few days. So, you know, better give it more weeks. Even months is better, you know, like that. So then the problem is, if you haven't learned, you'll have to do it again next life. And who knows what your situation is next life. So therefore, this life, we have the knowledge, take advantage, use it. So that's the problem. You understand? Genuine meaning according to the laws, because I don't have my rocks anymore. The genuine relation between this pillar and that pillar, right? You know, they're both pillars. They've been here a long time. Yes, but Krishna conscious relationship. But the point is you can be have a Krishna conscious relationship and you don't need to be married. But that's not exactly the point. But they need to be married. So the point is Krishna conscious relationship means following the laws that accompany a marriage. Right? Then the marriage will work. Right? The devotees getting married in their 50s. Right? I mean, let's say you had a devotee who was in the congregation. You hardly ever hear of him and he got married at 50. Are you worried about it? No. Or he's not part of the congregation, he just got married when he was 50 or 60. You like that, and then he joins Krishna consciousness. Are we worried about it? No. So, what we're talking about is those that were more dynamically involved in the Krishna conscious preaching and process, and then getting married at that stage. Right? Yes. So then we're looking at it that there must be something ethically wrong here. Right? But the problem is that, so it's not a matter of Krishna conscious. Were they not Krishna conscious? They were Krishna conscious. Right? So it's not a lack of Krishna consciousness why their marriage didn't work. It's lack of understanding what you're dealing with. You know what I'm saying? The guy doesn't know how to drive a car. He gets into a car and he's driving along thinking he's going to the temple, so he's remembering that. And then when the big truck somehow or another appears in front of his car going the opposite direction, he's thinking of Krishna. So was the problem his lack of Krishna consciousness? Well, it depends how fast the truck was driving. Does that make sense? So it's not a matter of not being Krishna conscious from the platform that we're defining. I mean, in other words, if the question is being asked, it means we're not understanding the kind of Krishna consciousness we're talking about. We're not understanding how to engage one's nature in Krishna's service. So once a grihastha, that's a conditioned nature. How does the conditioned nature of grihastha get engaged in Krishna's service? That we don't know. So you could say, yes, it's a lack of Krishna consciousness, but it's not the lack of Krishna consciousness that we're thinking it is. It's not because they're not chanting their japa, or it's not that you check all those families who are chanting their japa, their marriages are going great, and those families where they're not chanting their japa, they're the ones that are actually having the problem. Or all families that go to Mangalarti, they're not breaking up, but ones that don't go to Mangalarti, they're having the problem. You know, or maybe it's that they go to Mangalarti but don't stay for Tulsi Puja. You know, like that, or you know what I'm saying. You understand? So that's not the problem. The problem is they don't know what grihastha is, so they don't know how to engage it in Krishna's service. You know what I'm saying? So basically what you have is a brahmachari and brahmacharini living in the same ashram. That's all. Instead of it being two different ashrams in the temple. Now it's one ashram. But he acts like a brahmachari, she had brahmachari. They don't know anything how to interact with each other. Right? Does that make sense? So detachment's not interacting. Detachment is knowing how to interact and not having a result for yourself that you want from it. Right? So that's where we went back before. The teacher can function because they know how to deal with the kid. Right? But at the same time, is because there's nothing that you're trying to get from it, the child can only what they need from it take. They can't control you through it. You understand? The child with the parent can cry and control the parent. But the parent will deal and do this and do nice things and like that and then get them to stop crying. The teacher will do the same things, but the teacher doesn't have a need to gain from that. So the kid will understand that. Right? Because everything went like that, but they weren't able to get control. So if you're not going to get control, why do it? Does that make sense? So very quickly they just stop doing it. Right? In this environment, not necessarily when you go home.
Maharaj, so yes. In this question of the school,
Yes.
It seems very important that the parent and the school have the same shared vision on what Prabhupada expected.
Yes. Well, that's what we say, is that with the parents, unless they... We're not an alternative, or the other schools were full, or like that. No, it's if you don't know what we're doing and like that, don't even bother. Like that. Because otherwise, it won't work. Because... The mature devotees have problems dealing with the world of being a devotee and the world of having to work with the karmis, and they can't work the two out, so they choose one or the other. You know, generally the other, but you know, whatever. So the kids won't also have the environment of the home and the environment of the school. They're two different things. It won't work. They've got to choose one or the other. You know, and if they're young, they have to choose the parents' one. Because if they choose the school's one, the parent will make sure that they choose the home one. You know what I'm saying? So if they're not the same, we don't try. So that's why we spend time with the parent to see the parent. It may be a great kid, but the parent's not, we don't take the kid. If you can't work with the parent, you won't be able to actually work with the kid. Right? Because even if you have the same, that it was the, you know, that's become popular in the last years, an African saying, it takes a whole village to raise a child. So that's the point. So if the parents have their own ideas and separate from the others, the separatists in that, that means we wouldn't be able to be part of that village. And unfortunately for the child, neither will anyone else. So it's not just we have a problem, the child has a problem, because then the parent won't be able to work with others, devotees in the community or other members of the family or this or that. So it won't work. Because the point is, they can work with us, they can work with anybody. So, you know, or if you can work with others, you'll be able to work with us. It's just the principle is, are you the only one that knows what's best for your child, or is it that you're the one responsible to see that your child gets what is best? And you're taking part in the process, but you're not the whole process. It takes the whole community to be the full process. Those who understand that, then they'll raise good children, and they'll also be able to take part in, now coming in contact with Krishna consciousness, will be able to take part in that aspect also. That makes sense? Yeah? Yes.
Those points didn't cover the rasa aspect. They said of all rasa.
That was actually what we were explaining. Is that all three are explained, but this is an Upanishadic presentation, so it's based on the platform of detachment, so you don't have to get into those kind of details. Right? Does that make sense? But that it uses... He performs his transcendental activities only due to his causeless mercy. That's rasa.
It's about his spirit.
Yeah, like that. And then the other one is, you know, he expands through his diverse energies as the cosmic manifestation consisting of both matter and spirit for his pastimes. Yeah, only realized by devotional service. So they're inherent in there. But the point is this is Upanishad, so it's not going to go into great detail. But it's there. Right? So that's why the Smriti then will expand on that. Because its Puranas are dealing in the environment of Grihasthas. So it expands. The Upanishads aren't. So it's given... The idea is Upanishad means once thoughtful, one will take it and apply that into your life. Right? It'd be just like this. This would be, take an example. Okay. The supremely independent Lord Sri Krishna is never affected by his creation, although he is the cause of all causes. Since he is the complete absolute truth, the cosmic manifestation or annihilation does not change his fullness, devoid of any material need and desire. Okay? So, what are we dealing with here? We're dealing with Krishna and his creation, or Krishna's energies. Right? So then, manifesting is Krishna's creation. Right? So that means we're dealing with the masculine principle and the feminine principle. So that means if the masculine principle, and he's such a sankalpa, his desires are always fulfilled. Right? So he is devoid of any material need or desire. So all his desires are fulfilled. So now, applying this into your family life, a husband who, or a father who has material needs and desires, will he be able to affect that in interacting with his family? Means, will he be able to get it? Will he be able to gain the fulfillment of his desires if he acts from the platform of need? No. So, it's right there. We've read it a million times. Name me one grihastha that took this, converted it into that. Okay? Huh? Yeah, but that's in his books also. Yeah, but that's the point. He's doing it. He's a Prajapati. He is the son of Lord Brahma. You understand? So they're able to do that. But this is then taken and put into a pastime where you're able to see how someone who understands this acts. You know, it's like this. Lord Ramachandra's father, right, walks into the inner palace where his wife is, right? And when he walks in, she's not in the normal place to greet him. So he'll ask the maidservants, where is she? And they'll point to the room of lamentation, right? So he'll walk in there, and she'll have taken off her ornaments, thrown them around, you know, may have ripped her claws, she's rolling on the ground. And so does he walk in and go, what are you doing laying on the floor? You're going to get a cold. Do you know how much that cost to make those ornaments? We tried to make those really special for you so they weren't the same as all the other wives, like that. And you're just throwing them around like this and that. Is that how he's talking? So when these things happen, how are the husbands talking?
According to her needs.
That's how they should. But the family life he's talking about, it wasn't. So they don't even in reading this, they don't catch it. But when the wife is upset, you don't chastise, you don't that. You find out what it is and you try to deal with it. You take the humble platform. But if we do that, guaranteed the men will say, but you know, then you're emasculated, you have to show her you're the man and all this. Yes. So, therefore, they're getting married again at 50. Because neither the philosophy, neither the things in the Shastra, nothing they learn from. So, eventually, at least when you get so old you can't do anything, there's a good chance at that time you'll surrender and avoid having to come back again and go back to Godhead. So, it wasn't ideal. It's not something you put in the scripture, you know, that, you know, he, you know, all this and that. But it worked. He got frustrated with the material energy. He had no interest in it. And so when he died, he thought of Krishna.
There was a fault because we can see that many Prabhupada disciples are leaving their bodies in around 70s, so it might not work at proper time.
There, but there's always somehow another just the way things work out, you know. You have to see, you know, something is arranged like that. But the point is what I'm saying is that these kind of things, though they're there, we're not looking at it. So if they're not looking at it because they're so determined to be absorbed in direct devotional activities, it's technically not a fault. Because the direct devotional activities are a higher principle. So that they try to only be absorbed in the preaching and the sadhana, and their household life failed, technically is not a fault. But they didn't catch certain subtleties that Prabhupada is talking about that they could have included and been able to basically work on that and get through it. But, does that make sense? But to say, well, we're just being practical, that's not right. No, there's a science. So either don't worry about it, or if you're going to worry about it, then follow the science. Right? If you're not going to worry about the mundane laws, then don't worry about it. You know, it didn't go well, it fell apart, so that's the way it is. You know? You know, and if you're attached, then you get married again, but keep preaching. You know what I'm saying? And eventually that preaching will have its effect. But if you're going to retire from the preaching and say, now I'm going to get down to what I missed out on because I was being a fanatic and doing all that preaching, then that's dangerous. You know what I'm saying? In other words, you see those who are getting married but continuing their preaching, but those who are getting married stopping. So the stopping is the danger. So if they're going to stop, they should know what they're doing. And the other ones, even if they never find out how to materially make it, what does it matter? It's not, they're all still engaged in direct activities. Understand? So that's why he's saying you have to see the thing. It's not normal, mundane ethics. You would look at it one way, but we're looking at the spiritual. The ethics function in a different way.
Maharaj, in this case you mentioned, like, you stopped preaching. You were preaching very strongly, so you went back. And it means your identification with the materials can be very great then, because, like, spiritual didn't work. So now I will invest my energy. And that can be very dangerous.
That can be dangerous because you actually think that the material is the cause of happiness. Right? So that's going to be a problem. That'll be a problem because you actually think that you will be happy. You know, all that dissatisfaction you feel on the family front, that by being married that'll generate it. If that was true, then we'd have a whole planet full of satisfied married people. Because generally in most cultures, there is no concept of retiring. You're called retired, but they don't think of it as vanaprastha. It's not that they... Yeah. No, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, you're on a beach somewhere, you know, like that. You know, they never get there, but, you know. Does that make sense? Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki. Jai Srila Bhaktivedanta ki. Jai Nityananda Govinda Premanandini.